Ross Morning News. I'm Aaron Mason, filling in for Dave Ross. We have built an adopted technology, and it's all around us, that has changed the way humans interact with each other and know about the world around us. But we really haven't dealt with it and the harm that it could cause in the way that maybe we should, or at least that's the point of view of our guest this morning. His name is Joe Bock-Coleman. He is the lead author and a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Washington's Center for an Informed Public. Good morning, Joe. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's start with, what is the Center for an Informed Public?
The Center for an Informed Public is a group of researchers here at the University of Washington. And our mission is to resist strategic misinformation, promote an informed society, and strengthen democratic discourse.
I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that social media has been incredibly influential in not only how we communicate with each other, but also how we disseminate and receive information. So what impact do you think that has had on the collective behavior of humans?
So the short and scary answer is that we just don't know. As scientists, we have no good framework for answering whether or not some feature rolled out today will have a consequence tomorrow at societal scales. We know Twitter and Facebook and social media are going to be changing how we behave on global scales, but we have no way of evaluating what that will be or if it will be sustainable, equitable, and promote a healthy society.
Because of the priorities of these companies?
The priorities are part of it. I mean, all of these decisions are made to prioritize engagement and ad sales. And so it seems kind of unlikely that when you structure a society, a global society, around engagement and ad sales, that will happen to be the way to structure it for sustainability and for equity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scary thing, I think, for me and my co-authors is we don't really have an idea for what a healthy online discourse should look like. And, you know, we don't have anything in nature or in the universe that we've seen that is a stable 8 billion member social network connected through smartphones. We have no examples of that.
Right.
So one of the challenges that we advocate for that needs to be addressed in our paper is to have a scientific response to start to figure out what that might be.
Do you have any idea what motivates people, why everyone seems to be engaging in this, why it's so hard to leave social media once you've signed up?
Yeah, I mean, some of the brightest minds of my generation went to Silicon Valley to create one of the most complex pieces of machinery ever built, trained on petabytes of data to make us stay engaged.
Right.
If their market value, which is based on their ability to sell ads and influence behavior, is in any way built on something real, then that explains why we're so drawn into it.
Mm-hmm. You, in your paper, you mentioned crisis discipline. Can you define that for us? Tell us what that means.
Yeah, there's a phenomenal article from the 80s by Michael Soule, who it's entitled "What is Conservation Biology?" And at the time, they were trying to sort out what that field would be and what it would mean. And ecology is its own field where they examine the interactions of natural systems and try to understand how they work. Conservation biology, he argued, was a crisis discipline counterpoint to ecology. You don't know how the systems work in their entirety, but they're failing and you have to take some sort of evidence-based action. Mm-hmm. And he also likened this to medicine, where doctors have to make decisions about patients in the absence of a full understanding of their physiology and what's going wrong. And so in kind of the same way, we're arguing that our social systems are clearly going wrong and changing, and we're never going to have a full model, like a complete theory of society at scale. So given that, we have to find some way to make evidence-informed interventions or policy aimed at righting the ship.
Let's talk about policy for a second, because whenever you talk about government policy and the tech industry, I think it's pretty obvious that tech is moving much, much faster than legislation is able to keep up. What do we do about that? Is there some responsibility that these social media companies need to be taking? Is that something that you think might be able to solve this problem? Because as we've seen, especially over the pandemic, as people have gotten more isolated, there has been a tremendous amount of disinformation about COVID and the election, all kinds of things that have gotten spread. What do we do, Joe?
Well, you know, of course, at the moment, most of the ability to effect change is in the hands of these corporations because they have more or less complete control of their kind of opaque way of structuring the world. But if we look to history and other crisis disciplines, fossil fuel companies, tobacco companies, you know, big ag, like these mm-hmm. industries were not able to regulate themselves, right? Even with massive harms and damage. So it's a little unwise, I think, to expect that the solution will be internal.
That is Joseph Bach-Coleman. He is the lead author of a study, postdoctoral researcher at the University of Washington Center for an Informed Public. Thank you so much, Joe.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
It could be one of the most contentious election issues to hit Seattle ballots in years. And today, Compassion Seattle takes a big step in getting its proposed charter amendment on homelessness on the November ballot. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott explains.
Compassion Seattle is a mix of homeless advocates and providers who have teamed up with local business groups to back the charter amendment that essentially forces the city to take certain tangible actions to address our homeless crisis. Mike Stewart is with the Ballard Alliance and part of Compassion Seattle.
Really, there's sort of three things. So the updated charter amendment, it includes new languages that ensures that the city would really take a person-centered approach to fixing the crisis, noting that, you know, any work relocating people to housing should avoid any possible harm to individuals caused by closing encampments. It's kind of a first important point. Also reaffirms that the city would have the ability to close encampments that create, problems related to public safety or public health or interfere with the use of public spaces by others. And then the third kind of key component there is that a sunset provision was put in place. So meaning that, assuming this was passed by voters at the end of this year, 6 years later in the end of 2027, the charter amendment would then sunset at that point in time.
After some initial tweaks to the measure, the final version works out like this.
Charter Amendment 29 creates, if adopted by the voters of Seattle, creates a compassionate, outcome-based plan of action for dealing with homelessness in our city and primarily those living unsheltered in our parks, playfields, sidewalks across the city.
That's former Seattle Council member and short-time mayor Tim Burgess on with GeekWire's Mike Lewis in a recent edition of their Civic Conversations.
The last official count, which was in January of 2020, there's just over 3,700 of these individuals. They did not do the count this year because of COVID. So it's either the same or gone up. I don't think too many people think it's gone down in the number of people. So the major elements, if it's adopted, it requires the city government to invest more in behavioral health services, mental health, substance use disorder treatment services. It creates a behavioral health rapid response capability so that a team of mental health professionals and others can respond on some occasions in lieu of the police, who are not always the best response option.
After beating back a potential legal issue, Compassion Seattle was cleared to start gathering signatures in late May, with 33,000 qualified signatures needed. Today, the group will turn nearly double that in, with more than 66,000 signatures, enough to make it all but certain that this lands on the November ballot. If it does, and it passes, this amendment would basically circumvent the city council and, for the first time, add specific benchmarks and duties to Seattle's sometimes confusing and competitive, chaotic array of homeless services and programs.
And Hannah Scott now joins us live. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron.
So they're talking about a compassionate way. I heard the word compassion a lot. It is the Compassion Seattle name of the group. Now, what do they do once they clear people from encampments or public spaces? Where are they to go? Is that part of this plan?
Yes, it is absolutely part of this plan. So this plan, it requires you, they cannot start under the revised version, taking people out of any encampments they might be living in until they take certain steps that you heard Tim Burgess talk about there, which is have certain behavioral health programs up and running, wraparound services, if you will, to help those people have some place to go and kind of walk them on and through what comes next so that they're not just kind of trying to navigate this whole thing on their own. It's kind of the full picture. So it's required that that be up and running before they start to clear anybody out of any encampments. So you have some in that, some housing advocates or homeless advocates who are pushing back on this. There are flyers up around town that are speaking out against Compassion Seattle efforts. And it's because they say this is just going to be more sweeps and it's just trying to criminalize homelessness. But everyone, and again, you have to look at the collective here. You've got the Public Defenders Association, business groups, Downtown Seattle Association, various other housing and homeless advocates who all worked on this language and put it together after hearing input from all sides. So I think that you have really most everyone on the same page. There's just a few outliers, and the supporters here say there's no way. This is not about sweeps.
Well, thank you so much, Hannah Scott. That is Cairo Radio's very own. Thanks, Hannah.
Let's go.
It's time for Choke Points. Good to go account users have just over a day before the system goes dark for about 2 weeks. Sully is here with the latest.
Yeah, Good to Go was supposed to shut down in mid-June, but the state found a problem with the new vendor's system and gave it a couple of weeks to get it right. The state's Jennifer Charlebois says the issue was with the customer statements that they would have received once the system was back up and running.
The issue that we saw would have been confusing for customers when they got their first statements from the new system, and that wasn't a situation that we wanted to put our customers in. So we did take that pause to make sure that was corrected.
At 6 o'clock Friday night, the Good to Go website and the call center will go dark for about 2 weeks as the new systems are put in place. Patty Michaud is in charge of the call center. She's expecting a lot of last-minute calls during the closure.
We will be busy right up until Friday, right up until we shut down customer service, just wrapping up calls and customer inquiries.
Customers are still being asked to check all their information online before the closure. People without accounts are encouraged to pay their bills. But Charlebois says you'll be able to settle things once the new system opens up.
You know, if customers don't get to that this week, it's not a big deal. That can all be taken care of on the other side of the transition, right? We're just asking customers if they have time this week to, you know, to get that out of the way, because we are expecting there will be, you know, quite a few people wanting to take care of those activities once we reopen.
Once the system reopens, Charlebois says all 2 million Good to Go users will need to log in and make some initial changes.
That's a really important reminder for folks to make sure they do have access to their username and password, because those will be necessary to be able to log in to their new account once we open the new system.
You will have to change your password once you log in that first time, and then you'll be able to opt into some of the new features like text alerts or pay as you go instead of carrying a balance. The state has put some videos together to walk you through these steps. You can see them at mynorthwest.com. At the call center, Michaud says they're happy to be busy.
It's very busy right now, and I think the staff is pretty excited. I think they're looking forward to meeting our customers and helping them out and getting familiar with the new system. So it's kind of an exciting time at the call center.
Of course, you will still be told during the 2 week system closure, bills won't go out until the system is back online and you will have more time to pay them. The reason for the upgrade now, well, the system is more than 10 years old, doesn't really have the functionality that users now expect out of websites. The goal is to allow customers to handle most of their business on the web, leaving the call center to handle more difficult issues.
Yeah, it's not a 2 week free for all. Okay.
You still have to pay.
Know.
Yeah. The bills are still going to be collected and whatnot, but yeah, you'll have a little bit more to time after this is set up to take care of it.
I was just going to go back and forth, under the 99 tunnel, but, those plans are canceled. I do like the pay as you go. That's great. Instead of having that purse balance.
Yeah, so that's kind of an option. A lot of people I know before we went on, I went and reconciled my account, and I had no idea what my username and password was, so I had to end up calling the calling center. Even I had no idea, and they had to walk me through. The emails didn't come, and so that took me a little time to set that up. And then prior to, I put another $30 on in case we were going to be using it during the 2 weeks. But, yeah, I certainly plan on changing it to the pay-as-you-go, because there's no reason to hold a balance.
Yeah, that's silly.
I mean, on that, yeah, just pay when you use it.
I was actually going to ask you about, do you know if they have any plans to, after the 2 weeks are done and everything is back up, to remind people that they need to log in, to maybe deal with folks who, like you and like me, wouldn't remember necessarily username and password?
Yeah, certainly. There's been a ton of outreach, and that's one of the reasons why we've been doing a couple different stories on this thing to remind the public. I mean, there are 2 million good-to-go users, so imagine them all logging on at once this reopens. So there are going to be some things that people are going to need to be reminded about, especially that you have to log in and kind of set yourself back up again. So it's kind of like a great reset, but we'll remind everybody when we're doing that, and I know the state will be as well.
Sully, there's also going to be a memorial procession for Seattle police officer Lexi Harris today. Where and when is that happening?
Well, first, the memorial is at T-Mobile Park, and so you're going to start seeing a little bit later on this hour, probably in next hour, they're going to start closing off some streets around T-Mobile Park. So that's number one, is if you have business down there, you normally commute through that area, just be prepared. You might run into some street closures around T-Mobile. But then around 10:30 this morning, the memorial procession is going to start, and it's starting in Burien, and it's going to go north on 99. East on 518, so you could have some issues right around the airport there if you're going to SeaTac, and then northbound on I-5. So for a section there from basically South Center up to the Boeing Access Road, you're going to go off there and then head up Airport Way to kind of work your way into the Stadium District, down 4th into Edgar Martinez. So we're expecting some long delays as we go through that. And, of course, people are encouraged to be on overpasses and whatnot to recognize Officer Harris and whatnot. Certainly from that Airport Way on in is where they're going to pick up a lot more local police and fire vehicles. But there are going to be plenty on the route coming out of Burien.
And, again, what time of day?
10:30 is when it's supposed to start rolling in Burien, but the streets around T-Mobile Park could be started to be shut down later this hour.
Great. Thank you, Sully. More than 180,000 migrants were stopped along the southern border in just the month of May. CBS News correspondent Maria Villarreal spent a few hours on the border in Texas with a gun-toting pastor who does what he can to bring those migrants food and water.
Right now it's about 10:30. We're driving down to the edge of the river.
Pastor Luis Silva drives the banks of the Rio Grande River several times a week looking to help migrant families despite his political views.
I'm a guy that is trying to show the love of Christ, but at the same time, I respect our laws.
Moments after we arrive at the riverbank, a raft with 5 people pulls up, the first of several families to come ashore. They jump out, and less than a minute later, their guide turns the raft around, ready to pick up another group in Mexico.
Is there a concern that this could continue to get worse?
Yes, because, like I say, what the narrative that is used, it has repercussions, like I said. It had consequences.
And by the narrative, you mean empathy that is coming from the administration?
Yes.
Among the dozens of parents and children we saw was Teresita Elena. She's 9 years old and traveled with her family from Nicaragua for more than a month to get here.
She got here by car and also caminando también?
Sí, en trailer.
En trailer, en un trailer. Era un grande trailer o un chiquito?
Grande.
A very big trailer she also came.
Pastor Silva gives the group water and food before they walk to a makeshift processing site set up by Border Patrol.
There is well over 200 people here, men, women, and children. They will go from these lines, they will be processed by Border Patrol, and then they will be separated and taken to certain facilities depending on their age and if they came with a family or if they're an unaccompanied minor.
To fight the rising immigration numbers, Texas Governor Greg Abbott is asking for donations to help the state build a border wall.
In the name of Jesus.
En el nombre de Jesucristo. Amen.
Silva supports the border wall, but also believes the immigration system needs an overhaul.
They need to come up with a solution. And people will come as long as there's an opening.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A glass ceiling shattered. 60 years after her baseball dreams were crushed, a grandmother has fulfilled a lifelong goal of becoming a New York Yankees bat girl. CBS's Meg Oliver has the story.
This is it, people.
Gotham City has a new bat girl.
You gotta bounce in your step.
Gwen Goldman is the Cape Crusader, and this is her cave at Yankee Stadium. She's dreamed of this since she was 10, when GM Roy Hammy denied her a chance to break the grass ceiling on the field where so many Yankee legends played. In a game dominated by men, Hammy wrote, "A young lady such as yourself would feel out of place in a dugout." Though Goldman struck out, she kept the letter for 60 years.
Why did you keep this? Dreams and hopes.
Then her daughter, Abby, decided to send a copy of the letter to the 2021 Yankees.
Some dreams take longer than they should to be realized.
Current GM Brian Cashman invited Goldman, now 70 years old, to suit up.
I'm going to put on the pinstripes.
For one day, she was an honorary Batgirl.
As he throws out tonight's ceremonial first pitch.
What was going through your mind when you stepped out onto the diamond?
I wish I had practiced my throwing so I could have thrown some better balls.
So never give up on your dreams. As Yogi Berra once said, it ain't over till it's over.
He just made a dream come true for a young 10-year-old girl, a 70-year-old woman, and I couldn't be more honored to be here.
Meg Oliver, CBS News.
Turns out the New York Yankees were actually a league of her own.
Oh, I see what you did.
It was
there.
Her field of dreams. I'm sorry, I just can't resist.
Oh, Heather, but you're a natural.
Honestly, right. Good for her. Honestly, good for her.
Yeah, yeah.
That is so cool.
It's wonderful. And the idea that you know, I'm 40. So depending on how old you are, I'm either ancient or a baby, right? Right there in the middle. But I'm starting to see, you know, as I get older, the value of the really miracle it becomes to be able to fulfill like a childhood dream and how impactful that can be. And
yeah, make that happen. Good for her. Not giving up.
It's really inspiring stuff. Hey, while we're talking baseball, let's talk about those Mariners last night in Buffalo.
Well,
top of the 10th. It was tied 6-6.
Yeah. Murphy has the sign from Reese McGuire. And the pitch swung on and hit deep to left. Carrying high, far and gone. A three-run homer. Dylan Moore and the Mariners have a 9-6 lead. You got to love those three-run homers in the 10th inning. Gives him 26 runs batted in, and he went large right there just when the Mariners needed.
Final score, Mariners 9, Blue Jays 7. The M's have gone to extra innings 10 times this season, and they've won 9. They will face the Blue Jays again this morning, 10:07 a.m., first pitch on 710 ESPN Seattle. And
they're winning, but they're making us wait for it.
That's right. They're making you sweat. And they're playing in Buffalo, even though they're playing the Blue Jays, because right. Americans are not allowed.
That whole Canadian border.
In Canada. Yes, yes, yes. Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason filling in for Dave Ross. Now from the Gian Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, it's G. Scott. Good morning,
hey,
G.
Hey, good morning. Good morning to you and Heather. You guys doing all right on
good
this beautiful
morning.
Thursday?
Yeah, man. Excited about those temps. You know what I'm saying? It's high of 73. It just gets me giddy. I'm so excited. Listen, man.
What's up?
I don't mean to bring down the vibe. I love talking to you, having a good time. But yesterday, I don't know if you got whiplash the same way I did, but Bill Cosby is out of prison. His sexual assault conviction was reversed, which was based on a previous plea deal in a civil case. It sounds, you know, like one of those things you can do if you can afford lawyers, like he's got those high-priced attorneys. Bill Cosby, if all these things are true about him, or most of them even, we're talking about potentially one of, if not the most prolific serial rapist that we know about in the history of this country.
Right.
But we all know growing up with Bill Cosby, what we felt about him. I you know, we're just torn to either side. How are you feeling about this stuff today?
Torn. I ain't torn. Bill Cosby is a monster. Let me get into it. First of all, the criminal justice system, when you see things that would happen with Bill Cosby yesterday, is an example of sometimes you wonder if the criminal justice system cares more about the rich and guilty than the poor and innocent.
Mm-hmm.
What the reason why Bill Cosby is out of jail, the reason why the higher courts released him, is because a deal was made, and a deal was made with the devil, Bruce Castor. Bruce Castor, who was the district attorney at the time, Montgomery district attorney out there, said, hey, Bill, they made a deal.
Uh-huh.
And the deal was back in 2005, they made a deal like, hey, we will not charge you criminally. However, we're going to need you to testify civilly. Sign right here. So they sign.
Uh-huh.
And Bill Cosby goes on to testify under oath civilly. In that civil deal, he admits everything there is to do with just this one case.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't even include the other women that have come out against Bill Cosby. But in this case right here, Bill Cosby admits what he has done under oath because he does not lie. That's a civil thing. The civil deal was closed. It was sealed. We all know that it was opened back up. It was the reason why it helped put Bill Cosby into jail. And then, of course, that deal was made by the then the district attorney at the time, Bruce Castor, who made that deal in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which, by the way, is the right decision to release Bill Cosby from jail. I don't like it. But that is what the law said.
It's
like double jeopardy. I'm not a lawyer, but let's be real. Yeah, somebody is acquitted, like a O.J. Simpson, and then you come to find out, man, ain't nobody else did it but O.J.
Right.
But he can't be tried.
Nothing you can do about it.
Right.
That's the law.
Right.
So again, it's nasty. It's dirty. No. What did? By the way, what did Bruce Cass? What did he end up going to do? What did he go to do? What does he do? Oh, I know, that's right. He was one of the impeachment lawyers for Donald Trump in the second impeachment trial. Wow. That's right.
A busy boy.
That's a coincidence.
Question for you. Huh. Question for you, G. Do you think Castor would have made that deal post Me Too? Do you think it just was so unbelievable that someone like Cosby would commit this kind of crime? No one could conceive of it, therefore he cut him a deal?
I don't think he would have been able to make that deal post-Me Too. And that's why the Me Too movement was so important.
Right, because 60 women accused Cosby, ultimately.
Hey, Heather, I haven't... Here's the part that hurts, and I want to get personal.
Talk
here.
To me. What?
I'm going to get personal. My own auntie yesterday got on my Facebook post and said, those were groupies. Mm. It was late at night.
Mm.
What do you expect? Nobody goes up to hotel rooms at night and has drinks. What do you expect to happen? And I just think, first of all, it hurt me because you're someone that's in my family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's number one. Number two, it hurts me that we've had so much conversation.
Yeah.
And this is where we are? You mean to tell me we are still that far behind? So the answer to your question, Heather, before Me Too, this is what happened all the time.
Yeah.
This is what it was. Women goes into the workplace, whatever happens to you, so many women that are listening right now have had to go through so much, and that's why the Me Too movement was and is important.
It's a ridiculous notion to think that to in any way blame these women. If you were trying to get into an industry and it was a potentially dangerous situation, you would never be faulted for an accident on the workplace. Well, you shouldn't have been there in the first place. Mm-hmm. No, you're trying to develop a livelihood. These were people in entertainment, women in entertainment, generally speaking, who were trying to get tutelage from Bill Cosby. That's
often
how he got a lot
young.
Of them in. Like it's completely absurd to fault them.
I can't lie. It hurts. I've had people lie on me before. I've had one, maybe two people lie to lie on me. Yeah. I ain't never had 60.
Yep. Leave it at that. Thank you, G. Scott. Appreciate you, buddy.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.